Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. In 2012, the Canadian press ignited a firestorm of criticism by naming killer Luca Magnotta as its Newsmaker of the Year. But while the recognition was questionable for its sensitivity, there's no doubt that few people had captured the public's attention, like the young murderer and internet sensation. A male escort and sometimes model, Magnotta had earned his notoriety by videotaping himself stabbing Chinese student Lin Jun to death with an ice pick, dismembering the body before posting the video online. After mailing Jun's hands and feet to elementary schools, he then led Interpol on a manhunt that ended when he was arrested at an internet cafe in Berlin, where he was reading news stories about himself. An international celebrity in a macabre sort of way, with a legion of fans, Magnotta was brought back to Canada, convicted of first-degree murder, and sentenced to prison. During this time, Anna Yorkin, his estranged mother, troubled by Magnotta's abused childhood and her role in that, reconnected with her killer son. Despite his internet fame, Magnotta never agreed to any in-depth interviews. Now, Magnotta has given award-winning journalist and author Brian Whitney, Raw Deal, the Shawcross Letters, an exclusive look inside the mind of this social media killer. Joining Whitney to tell this unique true crime story is Anna Yorkin. The book also contains exclusive photos provided by Yorkin. The book that we're featuring this evening is My Son, the Killer, the untold story of Luca Magnotta and One Lunatic, One Ice Pick, with my special guest journalist and author, Brian Whitney. Welcome back to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Brian Whitney.
Hey, Dan. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Thank you for joining us with another very unique book, I would have to say.
Yeah.
My Son, the Killer. Let's talk about this very unique book because you've got, again, another exclusive. We mentioned in the introduction that he hasn't spoken to anybody despite this look like this very big need to be able to speak to some media. He hadn't. Tell us
right.
How you came to be in a position. Yes. Tell us how you came to be in a position to write this book, who you reached out to. Tell us those circumstances that led to this book, My
okay.
Son, the Killer.
Well, I mean, as you know, I've written a few books with Wild Blue Press, and one is Raw Deal with the Cannibal Cop, and the other one's The Shawcross Letters with John Paul Fay.
Right.
I've been on your show a couple times for both of those books, so long story
Absolutely.
Short, Anna Yorkin, who is Luca Magnotta's mother, had written a book, and she actually had received a deal for it with a fairly large Canadian publisher, and for whatever reason, the deal fell apart. She had approached Wild Blue. Wild Blue then hooked her up with me, feeling the book would be better if it had some sort of a journalistic aspect as opposed to just Anna's view of the story. And then at that point, I didn't think that Luca would be interested at all in talking to me, but it turned out that he was. So we spoke on the phone a few times, and we wrote each other numerous letters, which I think adds a lot to the flavor of the book, to say the least.
Absolutely. Now tell us how you first went ahead in approaching Luca to be able to do this. I know that you write in the book that because he trusted his mother's opinion and her
right.
belief that you were going to be appropriate to do this, and you could, she trusted you. But tell us how you first undertook to be able to put the story together, get the information from him. Tell us about that.
Well, yeah, Yeah, so that was it. He and Anna were estranged for a while, he and his mother, but they came back together. And at this point, they talk quite often. And she goes and visits him on occasion. Where she lives is quite far away from where he's incarcerated, but she still does go and visit him. And so Anna, once Anna and I started working together, we got along very well. And she asked Luca if he would do it, which obviously made things a little more complicated because, you know, I have to be impartial. I can't just write a cheerleading book for Luca Magnotta. You know, that probably wouldn't come across too well. So it was a little complicated in that sense, but it really was just the matter that he and his mother are close and Anna likes me, so Luca said he would do it.
Now, for the audience, tell us how this book is written in terms of content and sort of tone, sort of where this information is coming from and via who. So tell us a little bit about the...
Sure, and that's what I was sort of alluding to at the beginning. So originally the book was completely a book by Anna, and it was probably, I don't know, I mean, she might have had about 70,000 words that were just hers. And so I went through and cut a lot of it out and worked with her with the writing, and then I wrote my own chapter. So the book is kind of told, not totally in alternating chapters, but it's told, quite often there's a chapter that's hers and there's a chapter that's mine, and sometimes we actually even cover the exact same events, and I cover it, I tell the same story that she told, except I tell it in a slightly or vastly different way. And then there are other times that Luca, there's one chapter that's just purely me interviewing Luca, and then the rest of it is I take quotes from Luca and I kind of sprinkle them throughout the book in areas where I think they're sort of appropriate or interesting.
Before we get into the very bizarre story and his background, when you first spoke to Luca, what was his sort of, you talk about a 25-page missive. Basically,
right.
Before we get into this, where's he coming from in terms of thought-wise process, in terms of his attitude towards society, judicial system, everything? Just, what's his overall thing that he tried to convey to you in that missive?
It's interesting because I thought about this earlier. I was talking to somebody about this earlier today, and I think it's interesting because there wasn't much change in his kind of vibe now as it sort of was before when he was on social media, in the sense that he's very, you know, on the phone, he's jovial. Like, you know, we joked with each other and so on and so forth. But most of what I really got for the interviews from the book was by paper. So, you know, I'd ask him very direct questions and he would go on a very long, you know, he usually would give me a lot of detail, except for a few things that he didn't want to talk about, which mainly were was the actual crime itself. But so he kind of mocks the media. He mocks his psychiatrists. He mocks people you know, there's a lot of talk that he, you know, he say he has like 7 or 8 social media accounts. That's what the police say. That's kind of what the common knowledge is, that he had that. And he'll mock that and say that, oh no, that's not true. And people just want to be like me. And people just, you know, they're always harassing me. So it's that kind of thread of that he's been wronged kind of by everybody else sort of thing, I would say.
Absolutely. Yeah. Let's talk about, he was born Eric Kirk Newman, July 1982, born in Toronto, and we mentioned his mother, Anna Yorkin, and his father, Donald Newman, and his mother was 16, and his father, Donald, was 17. Tell us what imparted to you about Eric's life growing up.
He had a hard time. One of the interesting things is his father has been diagnosed with schizophrenia, but Anna doesn't really talk about that in her in her part of the book. I mean, Anna describes Luca's father as somebody that was very controlling and abusive, and I'm sure he probably was. He also apparently had a pretty severe mental illness, and they divorced at a fairly young age, and then Anna got into a relationship with another man who was by all accounts, at least by Anna and Luca's accounts, was very physically and emotionally abusive to both Anna and Luca and also the other children, but mostly Anna and Luca were abused by this guy. And Luca also had a really hard time fitting in at school. He was teased and bullied a lot and just didn't have the greatest childhood, according to Anna, for certain.
You talk about that compounding this problem is the philosophy that the father had, again, this seemingly schizophrenic Donald Newman, but the idea that they should be homeschooled, which didn't help, as you say, when he tried to go to school when he was 11 and 12 years old and was different as well, to add to the problem.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting thing, because if one were to go back and research what was initially being written about the case, it was that Anna wouldn't allow him to go to school, and that they wouldn't allow these kids to go anywhere, and so on and so forth. And Anna presents it much more as this was just kind of a normal homeschooling situation, but it also was not a healthy thing for Luca, mostly because of the way his father was, that he was very controlling and really just didn't want to let any of them out of his sight, so on and so forth. And yeah, by the time he did go to school, he was very socially and emotionally backwards, because he hadn't had any exposure to any other kids up to that point.
You also talk about that his parents split when he was 10 years old, and you talked about the other relationship with a man named Leo afterwards that Anna undertook. But also time spent with the grandmother and the grandfather, and in some of these, and outside of Toronto itself. So there was some time that even Anna and Luca could agree that it was a good time for him during that time and the relationship with his grandparents.
Yeah, he seemed to be doing okay at a certain point. He moved out. Leo is the person I was speaking of, the stepfather. So Luca moved out, I believe he was around 16 years old, as I recall. He moved out and moved in with his grandmother and seemed to be doing fine. But at the same point, again, we can talk about this later, but he definitely had, if you go through like the Watts report, it was the psychiatrist that did a report on Luca for his defense attorneys. Like, he had mental illness symptoms and diagnoses way back, even back then. It was just the kind of thing that Anna didn't seem to really want to talk about or think of at that time. So he was doing well, it seemed, outwardly, but I think there were a lot of signs that he was mentally ill from a younger age, even then.
From many times, that how did he present in terms of sexually and sexuality-wise, and how did the other students treat him? Again, what were some of the kind of nicknames? How was he treated at school? In what way did they abuse him?
Well, I mean, he was effeminate. He would do his hair and have his hair cut in a way that was not typical. His mother described it sort of as an M&M look, but he would dye his hair, and he was teased a lot when he first went to school. And didn't have really any allies at school. The teachers would try to get the other kids to stop bullying him, but it didn't really work. And he also, according to Anna, was teased a lot, even by members of his own extended family, for him being effeminate and dressing, acting oddly. So he definitely was kind of on an island there, I think, for quite a while.
You talked that short of him getting this high school diploma, he had dropped out, like you say, at 16 years old. He worked a variety of low-level jobs. But at that time, to reinforce what you're talking about, this diagnosis of mental illness, a recognition of it, he applied and was given government assistance because of mental health issues. Tell us a little bit about that, but despite that, what was his, how was he doing in terms of mentally and physically at that time, even after the stipend from the government?
Well, I think it's extremely important to note that, you know, if you read the book, you will see that, I don't know you have read the book, I mean, if someone were to read the book, you'll see that, Luca throughout will say that he's not mentally ill, that he's never been mentally ill. He says that his father's not mentally ill, that his father's never been mentally ill. And even with him saying all of that, I mean, he actually was at a very young age, as you just said, he was getting government benefits because of that exact fact. You know, that he was. So it's a confusing thing when you talk to him or read some of the interviews. He comes up very strongly against the fact that there's anything wrong with him, that he has any sort of mental illness. And in reality, he's been diagnosed as schizophrenic like numerous times. So to answer your question, but I just wanted to say that. So, you know, yeah, at that point, he dropped out of school and when he was almost done, and he worked a few dead-end jobs, and he lived at a group home for a while and was upset in the group home because, you know, everyone else was crazy, which is kind of a sort of recurring theme, if you get what I'm trying to say, with that situation where he's in a group home for the same reason that everybody else is, but he seems to think that everybody else is completely nuts, you know, and then he's just fine. So he was just pretty lost at that point, and he wasn't particularly close to his mom or his family at that point either, and was just kind of bouncing around for a little while.
You write that he started soon after sex work as an escort, but yet he was poor and he stole food on occasion, and then he got in trouble with the law. Now, this is interesting how there's the obvious criminal charges and conviction, and that perspective on the
right.
description of the crime itself. Tell us what he's charged with and this exploitation of this young woman, as it seems to be.
Yeah, that's what makes, to me, as somebody, I mean, obviously I wrote the book, but that's what makes the book interesting to me. So yeah, he got involved. According to his mother, he was taken advantage of by these two guys that sort of convinced him to just hang out with this woman. And they were the one that convinced this woman, and they kind of used her credit card without her permission. And all Luca did was go with her to the store. And Luca kind of does the same thing. He blames it all on these other people. But if you do research and see, you know, what actually happened is that this woman had some sort of development issues and had some special needs. And Luca himself was charged with, anyway, and convicted of basically taking advantage of her and using her to his gain financially by using her credit cards and doing things of that nature. So it's one of those things where the stories just don't really match up with what one can find by doing a little research into it.
What you do confirm in this book is that he, again, we talked about him starting sex work and escorts as an escort, and also that he began stripping, too, at a club called Remington's in Toronto.
Right.
Tell us about money issues and the kind of mental state he was in at that time, and along with stripping, what else did he participate in?
Well, and this was a sort of time that in a lot of ways, you know, he, his whole his whole escort, well, he, along with stripping, he basically started to do escort work. And again, if you talk to Luca about it, there's a situation where he presents himself as someone who's making enormous amount of money and like traveling around the world and was having the greatest time. And he had all sorts of fantastic clients. But again, if you look at the Watts report and other situations that other things that you can find, it appears that he was more doing some, you know, rather like low-level escort work. Now, that's not to say that he didn't have like some great clients that, in his mind, that paid him great money. I really don't know. I mean, there's so many things about this that only Luca really actually knows, you know, how much money he was making or how successful he was. But considering his lifestyle, it didn't seem to be at all like what he was presenting it as it was to other people in his life at the time. Mm-hmm.
You write, this was bizarre, I thought, was that this lifestyle that he had chosen for himself and his odd behavior was accepted at least by his mother at many times, at many points, without really going any further into why it was so accepted, you know, especially when it seemed like a mental illness that he was suffering from. You talk about the reality shows that he attempted to be on, Cover Guy,
right,
and Plastic Makes Perfect. But tell us, as you write in a book, when he talks about the glamorous escort work that he was doing, what was the kind of work that he actually did do as you dig in as a journalist? What kind of work was he doing, and what was his attitude about it?
Do you mean other than being an escort, or do you mean what kind of work he was doing? Just
well, what
in general?
Kind of work actually was he doing when you talk about the glamour and the high paying work that he did?
Yeah.
But in actuality, what kind of demeaning work was he participating?
Yeah,
in?
Well, I mean, he did get a little bit of work in some sort of like, you know, really low level porn kind of stuff, and he did get a little bit of modeling work, but I mean, for the most part, he was meeting guys, and they were paying him to pretty much do whatever they wanted with him, and he was, you know, put in some difficult situations, as anybody is that does that kind of work. I mean, the money is decent for a reason, because it's a pretty frightening and scary place to be at times. So, you know, he was basically, I mean, and this is the thing, because this is what makes it kind of really interesting to me, is because on the one hand, you have like how Luke is presenting himself, which is sort of this jet set, like high priced escort. And on the other hand, you have a guy that's like, you know, like struggling to get like government assistance and living in a crappy apartment and is sort of a low level male escort, just scraping by. And that sort of juxtaposition is kind of what makes everything about Lucas so interesting. I mean, you know, I wasn't there, you know, I can't say for certain what his life is like. I mean, what I'm going on is like a combination of what Lucas says, a combination of what Anna says, a combination of what the Watts report says, and a combination of what I can find, you know, through digging through different research sources. And they're all quite different. I mean, you know, it's a very complicated thing to unravel when it comes to Luca.
Now, with this, there's relationships. You talk about that he had a relationship with Ron, and they moved in together, and Ron told Luca that he insisted that he stop doing the escort service, but maybe he snuck around on the side and did some as well. But what's most bizarre is how the family's attitude, Anna and some of the siblings' attitude towards the work that he does and the money that he makes. That's what I wanted to ask you about.
Yeah, no, and I get what you're saying there. I mean, there's some things that are, you know, I like Anna. We get along well. I can't say like when I wrote the book with her, that I didn't think some of that was odd, you know, in the context of okay, here you have your son who's struggling, mentally ill, and prostituting himself. And I mean, I'm not a judgmental person at all. Obviously, that's part of, it's part of the reason I, you know, do this kind of work and write these kind of books. But at the same point, you know, it's a little confusing. Anna was upset with the boyfriend and so on and so forth, and that was part of the book. And it was definitely a situation, because that was something that, so yeah, he at one point like actually met a guy and stayed with him for a while and seemed to have some sort of stability, but the guy wouldn't really commit to Luca, and Luca went back to escorting again.
Mm-hmm. We talked about the dark side, but you say that comes with the territory. But as you write in this book, that, and I thought this is important, because he was mostly submissive in his escort work, and which entailed him being tied up and sometimes physically hit and humiliated. We'll leave it at that, is definitely humiliated.
Right.
And yet in all your correspondence, Luca is, you know, very adamant that he hates to be embarrassed. And the idea that someone like Ron could control him is very important as well, as we continue in this story, that somehow that Anna believes that he's very much like the time that he got involved with the girl with the super low IQ and took advantage of this young woman.
Right.
Very much Anna makes up excuses basically some of this dangerous work by Luca's assertion that he is being controlled by someone.
Yeah, no, it's definitely interesting. You're making very good points. I mean, when I said at the beginning that there was a manuscript and Wild Blue wanted me to be a part of it, I mean, this is why. I mean, it was you know, there was just a lot of it that you know, didn't quite pass the straight face test, you know, in certain ways. So yeah, and what you just said, and I know we're going to talk about this later, obviously, because it's a huge part of the case in the book. But you know, there's also an individual nanny that's brought up numerous times by Luca, who, even though he hates to be embarrassed, and he's this very strong person, and he doesn't care about anything, but then there's certain situations that occur that he goes out of his way to say that he was unable to stop doing a certain thing because someone else was controlling him. So it's definitely confusing for certain, the two faces that he's showing there.
Now, for established evidence of mental illness, there are incidents that you include in the book, a time where he is hospitalized in Miami. Tell us about a couple of these hospitalizations and if there was any diagnosis at that time, and what diagnosis, if any.
Yeah, I mean, I left most of them out. I mean, if I wanted to go through, that's what I was even saying about when he was younger, because again, there's reports that were introduced at trial. I mean, he just had a myriad of mental health situations that were documented. I mean, this one in particular that is sort of it's a big moment in the book and in his relationship with his mother, because basically what happens is she gets a call from a hospital in Miami. Luke is there. Supposedly he's been raped. Supposedly he doesn't know like how he got there. I mean, he's completely, you know, messed up. He's confused and so on and so forth. They ask Anna to vouch for his release, according to Anna. And she says, no, he should stay there. But then apparently his father said that it was okay for him to leave. So Luca left at this point, and he became upset with Anna for a variety of reasons. But this is one of those situations where, to an outside observer, it would be that Luca like suffered some sort of psychotic break. You know, that he had, I mean, a psychotic break, and that he was in Luca's mind, or at least what he was saying. I mean, he was brought there by this guy Manny, who beat him up. Like, he was raped by Manny and another man, and so on and so forth. And that was why he was in the hospital. So again, there are these two drastically different stories that an impartial observer, when they keep stacking up. So say there's like one thing like this that happens, you might be like, oh, you know, like this guy, this happened to this guy. But then when they just keep happening like over and over and over again, when the story doesn't really match up to the situation, that's when you have to really wonder what's going on. And Luca has, I mean, they just go on and on and on, as we'll talk about, I'm sure, in the next few minutes. But
now they're estranged, and yet there comes a time when there is a police detective that contacts Anna Yorkin. What is the content of that first contact, and what is it about?
The first contact. Give me a little more, because I'm trying to there was a thing with Romeo Salta. There was a thing with the kittens.
The kittens. The first
yeah.
contact. First.
Well,
some inkling
is something
of.
Yeah, I mean, this is something for me that. I mean, I'm the kind of person that I write true crime, and I obviously have great empathy and sympathy for the victim of any crime. But when it comes to animals, I just, oh man, it's like, it's really hard for me, really, really hard for me. So there came a time where Luca first, I believe that Anna heard from some people like outside of, I might be losing the chronology here, but regardless, people in, a police detective and people in Anna's family were approaching her about the fact that Luca might have been involved in some videos where he killed kittens, which is obviously very upsetting to Anna. And once again, Luca at first kind of said that he wasn't the person in the video, and then he called back and then even looked at the videos, and it was just an incredibly disturbing thing. And again, we, you know, at that point, when somebody's doing things of this nature and videotaping them, you know that there's something really, really going wrong, without a doubt.
That's what the detective expressed to Anna, was that they wanted to be
right.
able to find him potentially. And so what does Anna do in terms of that, in terms of cooperation with the police? And why?
Well, she did attempt to cooperate with the police. There was some frustration on her part down the road that in some ways, even though she was approached by the police, that she also didn't feel like the police took things all that seriously when it came to the cat videos. And at the same time, Luca was being PETA, the people for ethical treatment of animals were kind of after Luca and putting up rewards and trying to figure out like where he was and who did these things to the cats, which are really awful things. I mean, it's hard when you're doing an interview like this because even in the book, like, I didn't really want to describe things
mm-hmm.
that much. I mean, if somebody really wants to go watch them, they could find them. But you know, it's uncomfortable, you know? So, I mean, I don't know how much detail you want me to go in, but I mean, the things that he was doing were involving, you know, kittens and snakes and vacuum cleaners and, you know, just really, really awful, awful things. There's really no other way to put it, you know?
What's most important is that, like you say, PETA and all kinds of the separate groups are trying to find this person. They're even trying to employ Ron Jeremy in a scheme to lure this
right.
kitten killer out.
But right,
the most important
right.
and telling, I think, is the contact he has with British journalist Alex West. First,
yeah.
as Luca Magnotta, now what he's changed his name to, but also afterwards a letter is received by Alex West. Tell us about that.
Well, Alex West is a journalist, and I can't remember the exact paper off the top of my head, but it was a London newspaper, and he confronted Luca, and Luca was about the kitten videos, and Luca was very defensive. And then so much of this, it's kind of important to say that almost everything that I'm saying that Luca did, Luca denied in some sense that he did. You know, so with me saying that Luca did something, I mean, this is common knowledge that Luca did something, but he said that he didn't, and I'm not necessarily even calling him a liar. I'm just saying, in theory and in probability and in almost surety, like Luca then sent Alex West a letter. It was sort of taunting him about like how he always gets away with things, and next time it wouldn't just be pussies, it would be humans. And he signed the letter, John Kilbride, who was a victim of a murder by a couple of English serial killers, Maura Hindley, and I'm losing the guy's name right now. I'm sure you'll know. Regardless. So very, very disturbing. Again, not just the fact that he had done something so disturbing, but then it gets to the point that when he's confronted with it, he goes into some sort of taunting mode, and then also foreshadows that he's going to start doing things that are even more shocking and no one's going to be able to stop him.
Absolutely. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second to talk about our sponsor, Talkspace. Tonight's episode is sponsored by Talkspace, the online therapy company that lets you message a licensed therapist from anywhere at any time. All you need is a computer or the Talkspace mobile app. That means you can improve your mental health even if you've had trouble making time for it in the past. Get something off your chest whenever you need to. Talk about everyday challenges at work or at home. Just talk about your life. There are no extra commutes, no leaving the office. Talkspace is there whenever you are, wherever you are, ready to talk. Therapy isn't just about venting your most private thoughts or exploring childhood memories. It's also about practical, everyday strategies for stress management and living a happier life. Having a therapist simply provides you a designated person for you to talk to, that person trained to listen and help you make positive changes. The Talkspace platform has over 2,000 licensed therapists who are experienced in addressing life challenges we all face. To match with a perfect therapist for a fraction of traditional therapy, go to Talkspace.com/murder and use the code MURDER to get $45 off your first month and show your support for this show. That's MURDER and Talkspace.com/murder. Now, we have the world's attention, and Luca has been reported, there was numerous social media activity, and including a warning that was, and you can tell our audience about some of the things that he did prior to posting One Lunatic, One Ice Pick. Tell us what he did in the preceding couple weeks beforehand.
Well, it's probably important to say briefly, Luca's whole scene with social media. So he would spend a lot of time getting on social media and sort of like puffing himself up. We Photoshop himself, or we'd pay people to Photoshop him at times, like in different spots, like make it look like he was in Russia or make it look like he was behind the wheel of a big sports car. And then he had so many accounts that he would also comment on the original post and say, wow, that Luca Magnotta is so, and again, he denies this, but law enforcement said he had like 70 to 80 accounts. So like at one point he started a rumor that he was dating Carla Homolka, who was partnered with Paul Bernardo in Canada and were very famous serial killers. Carla was released and so all of this. So after the cat situation and before before the One Lunatic, One Icepick video, there started to be things that were posted in different places where Luca, under different accounts, would say things of the nature of like, oh, there's going to be a new video called One Lunatic, One Icepick. Has anyone seen it? And sort of like teasing the fact that, something was coming up of that nature. I mean, he wouldn't actually say what it was, but he already had come up with a name, and he was kind of putting it out there of something that, was going to happen.
Now, tell us about the genesis of how authorities find out that, number one, the video is authentic. How does it come to their attention, the video in the first place? And what is the reaction from police? And what happens back at the apartment building that Luca has rented an apartment? Tell us about what happens.
You're talking about like after the act had already occurred and the video was posted?
Yes.
Okay. I believe, again, Luca says that he did not post the video. He says there's no way anyone can prove that anyone can post the video.
Sure.
There was a video posted, I believe, on a site, which I don't think is up anymore, called Kevin666.com. And people, a few people noticed it, and it started to be a situation of, like, people started being like, could this possibly be real? And then eventually it was put up on BestGore.com. And coincidentally, or maybe not so much, but I did a book of interviews one time with a publisher called Head Press in the UK, and the owner of BestScore.com is a guy named Mark Merrick. And Mark, I interviewed Mark for the book, and Mark went to jail for 6 months in Canada just for posting the video. You know? I mean that's how bad the video is. I mean, he went to jail for corrupting morals, was the actual charge. So at this point, again, people were sort of wondering if this was real and if it wasn't, because it's so horrific. It's so absolutely horrific. You can see how people would not be sure if it was real. And basically, it ended up being tied in to what happened with when body parts were found outside of Luca's apartment, is when they started piecing it together that this was actually real, and this very likely was the person that was in the video that they found.
Mm-hmm. And then the manhunt ensues, and then a special Interpol manhunt as well. We didn't mention in the introduction that he actually sends body parts of this John Lynn victim to the political parties, the Conservative Political Party and the Liberal Political Party, and then a couple elementary schools in Vancouver for shock value, obviously. At the same time this is going on in this manhunt, and you say the police are putting things together, and of course part of that is the surveillance camera footage so that they can detail what Luca did or didn't do after this video was made. Now, when we talk about this video, I did a program about Luca, and I thought I have to take a look at this video. Not that I wanted to, but I did take a look
not
at
me
it.
Not either.
But you do say you wrote about, and I won't ask you about the contents of the video because we don't have to go through that. But needless to say that you write in the book that authorities were finding some of that evidence in garbage bags, just as they found the victim in a suitcase, again, ready to be put out to the trash, had been there for a few days. Then this manhunt, and we talk about that they were looking for him, and everyone knows that he was arrested at an internet cafe in Berlin, supposedly reading stories about himself online when he was arrested. One of the owner of this cafe recognized him, ran out, and interestingly grabbed a bunch of young officers, were in training, seven of them. And so they were in and questioned him, and quickly he confessed. you write in the book, and was very interesting, of course, perspective, is that Anna and her family are hearing rumblings and rumors, and the police have been there before but didn't give them any information, but she has a gut feeling about what's going on. And in the book, you capture that horror of any family finding out about another family member and being involved in this. Tell us a little bit about that you capture in this book.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really, and it's a big part of the book. I mean, when you talk about the book, you know, it's really, it's so much of it's just shock value, and rightfully so. I mean, it's just an amazingly horrific case. But so much of the book is really about being a mother of somebody that you love, that you know is troubled, and then you find out that they've done just this absolutely, you know, horrific thing. And not just a horrific thing, but a horrific thing. I mean, in Canada, Luca is like Casey Anthony or O.J. Simpson, you know, or Jean Benet.
Yeah.
It's like Luca is like, it's that big. So, I mean, she literally she was not only dealing with the fact that her son had done something unspeakably horrible, but she also was dealing with a media crush that, unless I don't think anyone could possibly imagine it other than somebody that actually,
right,
that actually went through it. So yeah, a big part of the book is Anna's, you know, what Anna went through, and then also coming to terms with who her son is, and then loving him anyway, despite this so horrific thing that happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she really does write about her understanding and empathy for her son and her undivided love despite everything, and yet does not dismiss John Lynn's family or other people about the horror of what her son had actually done.
Yeah.
And yet she does talk about building that relationship again and being in contact with them. But what I thought was very interesting is that the way she describes the media, you say the media crush, that they had to draw the drapes and the curtains in their home and the virtual prisoners in their own home. And then her grandmother, her mother, Phyllis, again, the media was relentless. You said they were in the trees. You know, we sort of assign this sort of behavior to American paparazzi, but it was interesting to see this level of paparazzi and relentlessness, as she writes, with them trying to get a story at any cost, despite anybody's feelings. I'm going to say any sensitivity towards the victim's family was not given and afforded them. That sounds quite believable, certainly.
Yeah, I mean it's and I think you mentioned in the opening, but he was named by the reporters in Canada, like 2012's like Canadian Newsmaker of the Year, which irritated a lot of people in Canada, like, and rightfully so. But when you say that, you think about America being that way. I mean, one has to wonder if maybe it was so big because things like this don't happen in Canada, you know, that it was just such a aberration that it just, and again, it was like, the video itself, it was just so shocking. I mean, it's just so shocking that I think it just upset everyone's sensibilities so much that there had to be some sort of strong visceral reaction to it by people. But then Anna was just in this incredibly, incredibly difficult situation. It's impossible for anybody. The epitome of a no-win situation, you know, when something like that, when a family member does something like that.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting too. We don't realize, but via your fascinating book, we do, that she is finding out information as it unfolds on CNN, which is, you know, an incredible moment where she doesn't want it to be. The family's prepared that it could be. But all of the real details, the horrific details of what her son did to this other human being, she's learning about it like everyone else. She's hearing the details on TV. after an international audience has he's gained their attention.
Yeah, I mean, it's something I think that's just not so much about this case is just not imaginable. It's just a very, very, very bizarre situation that somebody would do something, you know, so depraved, and then to have a family member, a mother, you know, sitting there and having this recognition that it's your son that is the one that everybody in the entire country is searching for. You know, she does a good job, I think, with expressing herself in those moments too, because it has to be a really hard thing to even express. I mean, how can you tell a story about something like that, you know, unless you've actually gone through something like that? I mean, it's just incredible.
Mm-hmm. As she writes, she describes her decision to reconnect. She does not, and no one in the family goes to the trial itself. As you write, they refuse, and I mean very, very adamantly, that they will not testify. And then they get assurances from the defense lawyer, LeClaire, and he betrays them on that and then subpoenas them. And they do a fantastic job being witnesses that are hostile and do not, as they assured them, that they would not testify. And yet, Anna is visiting and reconnecting, writing telephone calls, a big many, many hour journey to go visit him and reconnect with her son, who she seems to understand, believe had a mental illness, believe in his overall worth, and believe in that her son now needs her. Again, we alluded to it in the beginning a little bit, that she felt some kind of doubt, or pardon me, guilt, for having subjected her son to not only one abusive father, but also a abusive stepfather. You talk about Luca and we mentioned this Manny. So as the trial is looming, and in terms of defense, and in terms of this story about Manny that you get from Anna and her belief in the story, and Luca's representation of this person, Manny, and his participation in this video. Tell us about this assertion by Luca, and who accepts it or doesn't accept his explanation.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is there's a person that becomes a thread throughout the book and throughout the story, and that person is somebody named Manny, who in theory Luca was having a relationship with, but also in theory would you know, would beat Luca. Like he would do all these horrible things to Luca. He'd humiliate Luca. He would just you know, in ways that are incredible to even think about. Sexually, we would degrade him. He would you know, so on and so forth. So then, when it gets to the cat videos, the kitten videos, apparently, according to Luca, Manny was the one choreographing this whole thing that made Luca kill the kittens, and it was out in the hallway and saying, like, oh, if you don't kill the kittens, I'm going to punch you, or I'm going to do this to you, or so on and so forth. Now, this is where, to me, it gets kind of very interesting on a few different levels, because I don't think anybody could make me kill kittens. You know what I'm saying? I just don't think anybody could make me do it. So there's that, first of all. And then there becomes another level of nobody has ever really seen this guy. Now, Luca has said to me that all he says is, when I've asked him about it, he's like, well, the people that know us, and I don't care. He's basically, which is kind of his attitude about everything around this type of thing. He's like, I don't care what anybody thinks. Like, I know that Manny's real, and Manny's real, and Manny, like, did all this stuff. So then when it comes to the One Lunatic, One Ice Pick video, again, a lot of what I write in the book comes from Luca's interviews with Dr. Watts, and throughout, he didn't tell me much at all. He would talk to me about everything except for the kitten videos and the One Lunatic, One Ice Pick video, which makes sense in one way, so I'm not saying that's that odd, but he didn't talk to me about length about anything. But if I asked him about either one of those things, he'd just be kind of like, well, all I'm saying is people don't really know what happened, But with Watts, he told this story of how Manny orchestrated the whole thing. Manny was the one that got him and the victim together. Manny was the one that told him what to do. Manny threatened him. Manny orchestrated everything throughout the whole process. So, I mean, basically, it's one of two things, you know. And one thing is that Manny did actually do all these things, which still doesn't explain why Luca would just follow blindly some guy like Manny telling him to do these incredibly horrific things.
Sure.
And the other is that Luke is severely mentally ill, and that you know, Manny is not real. It's a voice that he hears, and he's had a series of psychotic breaks, and has identified Manny as the voice that he hears, or even maybe a person that he sees. I mean, it's impossible to know. But there are definitely like auditory and visual hallucinations. So it's a really interesting part of the book to me, because with Anna, she really was like, you know, yeah, like I can't believe Manny did all this stuff to him. And when I'm reading it, I'm like, man, you know, I mean, no one's found this guy. I mean, this is one of the most famous like cases ever. And here's a person supposedly like orchestrating this whole thing. But there's no actual proof of them, so it's just bizarre and not bizarre all at once, because there seems to be a rather logical explanation to it. But even the media never really talked about the extent of, because if he is mentally ill, which it seems to me that he is, even though if Luca hears this, he'll be extremely angry at me. You know, that I say this. If he is mentally ill, and he's really, really mentally ill, you know, and it seems like that should potentially be, I'm not saying he should not be locked up. That's not for me to decide, but that part of the story seemed to be sort of like just swept under the rug, and presented Luca as just sort of this like really evil person instead of like this really, really ill person. What he did was awful either way, but I think you get the point that I'm trying to make. Yeah.
Anna, his mother, believes that he's mentally ill and that the system severely failed him at different points along the line, and this was a preventable tragedy. When they go to court, in Canada, it's not criminally responsible, otherwise known as insanity defense. A little different, though, how it's applied, I would say, if you look at some case law. But regardless, to say this, it looks like this guy would definitely qualify for not criminally responsible or NCR defense. Dr. Watts definitely would assess him as being mentally ill. Again, no cooperation from Luca Magnotta concerning this Manny person, so...
No.
It didn't seem feasible or believable to me at all. Now, this not criminally responsible designation, he doesn't testify at trial. What I found interesting is and Anna was critical of this, the defense lawyer's behavior, but this LeClaire really tried his best to try to get the family to reinforce with their testimony this not criminally responsible defense. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, that whole thing's interesting, because even when you and again, I really like Anna. Anna's a really, really nice lady, and we get along great. But that whole concept is interesting, because even when you say, which is true, that she believes he's not criminally responsible, she still doesn't buy the whole schizophrenic thing, even though he's been diagnosed with it like numerous times. She still is like, well, I'm not really sure if he's schizophrenic or not. And even though she says he's not criminally responsible, she also thinks Manny's a real person. You know, so it's kind of hard for me to justify those two things. I could never really quite wrap my head around that, because I would think if you would feel that he was not criminally responsible, mentally ill, that you would feel that Manny was not a real person and that he was schizophrenic. So yeah, I didn't really get that. And I also think, in Anna's defense, I mean, Anna's a pretty, she's a pretty nervous person, and you know, I mean, she originally was going to do this show with me tonight, and she got nervous, and we have some other things like coming up, and she was like, I can't really do them right now. And I think that she's that kind of person that, again, it's hard to imagine, and I certainly cannot, that kind of vibe of, like, you know, going to testify in court in your son's murder trial when the media, which even without media would be just amazingly awful. But then in that, with that sort of media, I just don't think she thought she had the ability to do it. You know, so it's, you know, would it have helped? I mean, possibly, but at the same point, I don't know if it would have helped or not. Especially when Luca himself was, you know, he went along with it, but he told me numerous times that he didn't at all, like, agree with it, that he didn't agree with LeClaire wanting to do it, you know, and so on and so forth. So, you know, it's really hard to know in hindsight, like, if she had testified, whether that would have, like, helped or not.
Yeah, she writes that she didn't think it would help, and I think I tend to agree. I think maybe I'll ask you what you think. Regardless of what it seems like, and in Canadian law, there is a lot more, let's put it this way, there's a lot more success with an NCR, an insanity defense, than ever would be in America. I would say that's, without rolling out some statistics, I would say that that's pretty evident. Why do you think that, you know, we haven't talked about the verdict? Well, let's talk about the verdict, because there was a possibility of first-degree murder, second-degree murder, and manslaughter, and then not criminally responsible. What was the verdict by the jury, and what was the... And what was that reaction like by the media after that?
Well, I mean, as far as, like, the reaction to the media, like, I'm not sure if I can even... I mean, I know that people were definitely would have been a lot more upset if he was found not criminally responsible than,
right,
you know, than the situation that actually occurred. And I also know that, you know, in that situation of the difference between America and Canada as well, that he received, like, he might be in there for life, but he could potentially be out in 25 years.
Right.
You know, from when he first was convicted. So I think as far as the media goes, I mean, it's difficult to know, like, you know, what would have happened, like, if the other situation was turned in, as opposed to, like, what actually ended up happening.
Mm-hmm. It seems in this case that there wasn't, even in Canada, wasn't so much sympathy for him and his mental illness because of the horrendous, and you write about this as well, it's seemingly the purpose. Luca would disagree, but the purpose behind posting this video and doing what he did to that victim in the video, as you do in the book, can you discuss that?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that last part?
When you talked about his motivation for this, the reason why he did any of this, posting of the video online,
okay,
and also what he did to the victim, what do you think was the real purpose behind that?
Yeah, now that's a really good question, because again, it's one of those things that something is just so out there and so bizarre that to try to, like, even put some sort of rational reason, you know, behind it is very difficult to do. But in my opinion, all of this had to do with some really warped version of, like, wanting fame, wanted to be thought of as tough, wanted to be thought of as scary, wanted to be thought of as important. And for it to come out in that manner is certainly, you know, completely odd and bizarre for it to like actually come out in that way, for someone to behave that way to get these goals. Like, you know, if you have these goals, like, this wouldn't be the way that a normal person would think about achieving them, obviously. You know, to like, to kill somebody in the most horrific way possible and videotape yourself doing it while abusing a corpse is not the way that somebody would necessarily think of like themselves to like, oh, I want to be famous and cool and thought of as scary and so on and so forth. But everything that went on from the very start of like the photoshopping, all the different accounts, the cat videos, it was all just this really odd escalation, which again, Luke will deny all of it, you know, as far as like him doing any of this stuff. But to Watts in the Watts report and other situations, I mean, he in theory did admit that, like, you know, he wasn't quite sure why he did this. He just wanted to look tough. He wanted to freak people out. He wanted to appear more than he was. You know, he wanted to be famous. And obviously that's what's ended up happening. But it's hard to imagine that he would thought that he could have gotten away with it. So that's the part that's really odd. To me.
Well, obviously, didn't think he was going to get away with it. It was the fame that he would get, the infamy that he would derive from this. It certainly got everyone's attention. And like I've said before, I've commented before, it seems like some of the Canadians are trying to compete with American serial killers. And like very much like Canadians doing anything, our heroes are entertainers in America. When you've made it big, you've made it in America. So that's what I see here.
And that's a really good point when you say obviously didn't think he was going to get away from it. And I think you're correct. But at the same point, I mean, think about the cat videos, and he did actually get away with it. And then what happened was, too, is then his paranoia, like, ramped, like, right up. Like, sure. Once PETA and other people started, like, you know, being like, oh, Luca Magnotta is the person that did this with the cats, and he thought that the police might be after him, and he'd walk down the street, he'd be like, is this person going to kill me? Is this person going to attack me? Does this person hate me? Does this person know who I was? So, like, he was at a very, very heightened sense of paranoia. When he committed the crime, the video crime, the one lunatic, one ice pick crime. And at the same point, you know, he had gotten away with something. So if somebody is really that irrational, which obviously if you're doing what he's doing, I mean, you're incredibly irrational. So I think you're correct that he must have known that he was going to get caught. But at the same point, it seemed like maybe he thought that there would just be all these rumors, just like Carla Homolka and the cat videos. Oh, maybe Luca was the one that did that amazing thing, but no one would actually know for sure it was him, you know? I don't know. I mean, because, again, he won't – you know, Anna's told me, too. He doesn't like talking about it. I mean, it's like that thing he just doesn't like to talk about. You know, before I interviewed him, she was like, oh, he'll talk to you about anything, but he just doesn't like to talk about that. So, I mean, it's hard to tell whether he even, you know, really knows exactly what happened that day, and what he was thinking, what he was planning.
The jury didn't believe that he was not criminally responsible, and he was given a life sentence with the eligibility of parole after 25 years. But very much like I would have to say to an American audience and world audience that very much like, Paul Bernardo, I doubt that he will ever be released from prison because of the Canadian perception. Just very much like any members of the Manson family, it is politically suicide to be able to be supporting anybody like that for their release. So I think it would be the same in this particular case. It was interesting and fascinating in this book, too, is Anna and her admirable support of her son. If she believes he's troubled and mentally ill, and that's what she does believe, and that the system, Canadian system, judicial system, healthcare system failed him, it's interesting that, and admirable, like I say, that her support of him, and a very, again, especially for, I think, an American audience, this private visit that she's entitled to with Luca at the prison after he is sentenced to a life sentence. Tell us a little bit about that fascinating part of the book.
Well, after Anna reconciled with Luca and he was incarcerated, she ended up applying for like a family visit sort of thing where she actually went and hung out with Luca in like a nice, like well-appointed trailer, like outside of the prison, and spent time with him where they, you know, just hung out and did their thing and spent time and tried to get reacquainted. And what's interesting too, in these sections of the book, and I don't know if maybe it's interesting to me more so than it would be a reader. But she's very focused on just like how great she thinks Luca is and how wonderful it is to be with him and that big smile, and kind of presents it like, you know, in some ways that, you know, it's just like when she sees him, it's just sort of like being, you know, being back at home with him and so on and so forth. And at the same point, she had a difficult time being in that environment, you know, which again, a lot of people would be. But so, yeah, like Canada has like a system where, you know, people can apply and they can, you know, people can just come visit in a big, well-appointed place and just hang out for a period of time. I also can't remember the hours. She left, I think, after like 48 hours, but I think it was supposed to be like for 3 or 4 days that she was allowed to allowed mm-hmm. to do it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very disturbing but fascinating and understandable, her, what she writes in the book. And again, it's just fascinating, and I congratulate you for being able to, again, be able to get this into a book. It's incredible, this perspective and this access. But I thought one of the most bizarre things was that when they spent this, basically what would have been a conjugal visit if they were man and wife, that they have this visit and they sleep in bedrooms and there's, you know, everything that they would have,
right,
like it was a little apartment or something. And she said, you know, again, this admiration and joy in being around Luca and being reconnected to him and enjoying his conversation and his company. And she said she felt like going into his room and tucking him in for the night, just like when he was a little boy. And I said, wow.
right. Well, I know. I mean, I think I think that is, again, it's kind of a, I mean, I read a lot and I obviously write as well. It's an odd book. I mean, it's an odd book in the context of, again, you have Luca's quotes, you have Anna sometimes being like, there's a section that I made shorter, but there's a long section about Luca getting married in prison.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
Where he married a man that had actually been also incarcerated because he had killed somebody. And the way she talks about it is just like, oh, I'm going to see my son get married. And like, you know, she's so like happy and excited about the whole thing. You know, it's in one way, it's very, you know, it's a bit uplifting. In another way, it's definitely not something, again, that most of us could relate to. So, you know, it's I appreciate that you found it interesting. It was a bit challenging, but I enjoyed doing it.
Yes, absolutely. It's fascinating to get inside the mindset of a serial killer or one-time, you know, murder spectacle killer. And we don't quite get that because of this. Basically, Luca seems to be at odds with a lot of the information, as you say, that seems to be evidence, and he will deny that. And I think most telling is that he says he doesn't have any mental illness whatsoever. So I think that encapsulates everything right there, I would think.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's but he's so, I mean, when you talk to him, I mean, he's so he's definitely charming. I mean, he's definitely intelligent. And, you know, I think there's a lot of us that have some form of mental illness, and a lot of us could say, oh yeah, you know, I have some mental illness, but I definitely wouldn't have done something like that, you know, but Luke is not even able to go that far, you know, into admitting that he might have any sort of problems at all. I mean, I think that's what's fascinating about Luca to me. I mean, he really doesn't admit he has any problems. I mean, pretty much every situation that occurred, from the rumors about Carla Homolka to the kitten videos to the situation, you know, with the video that was posted all over the world, to even his escape. Even his escape, he says that he wasn't trying to escape. I don't know if you caught that. He's like, oh, I wasn't trying to escape. I was just taking a vacation. I didn't even know they were looking for me. I mean, there's so much of it that doesn't pass the straight face test when it comes to that. So, but at the same point, he's a very I don't know. I mean, when I interviewed him, and even when I got the interviews from him, I was like, man, this guy really takes it as far as he can. There's no doubt about that. He doesn't doesn't do anything halfway. That's for sure.
What I thought was most convincing about Luca, and I thank Christ, I think, for this, is that if he were truly psychopathic versus, and I don't know if you can mix both of them, I don't think he'd be, I don't know, who knows, half psychopathic,
right,
plus be insane, I don't know if it's mixed, maybe that's what's next on the,
I know
the show.
I know what you're saying, yeah.
But the thing is that thank God he didn't cooperate with this lawyer, and thank God he didn't have a better lawyer or a team of lawyers, and the family didn't cooperate more. But if he was truly psychopathic, I think this trial would have had more appeals, which he abandoned his appeal. So I think that if he truly were psychopathic versus severely mentally ill, I think maybe we would have been in for a worse trial. I think he might have reached out to the media in a more disgusting way. There was bizarrely
very good
talk
point
about
I never even thought
John
about
Lin.
That.
Yeah, and John Lin's father was looking for closure, came to the trial, came to the preliminary, seemed like satisfied with the sentence, but he wanted an explanation. And I thought the most bizarre thing would be Luca trying to explain, because there is no explaining this, is there? No way.
No, and I mean, that's a really good point. I mean, because I honestly, that never occurred to me. And if you have somebody like Kenneth Bianchi, like one of the Hillside Stranglers, for example, I mean, here's somebody that like went out of his way to convince everybody that he was completely mentally ill, you know, played the part up to a T. Then you have Luca, who's got everything he already at hand that he could use. Be like, oh, look at this and look at that. Like, look at all the records that I have. Like, look at this incident in Miami. Look at this incident with the kittens. Like, and he didn't use any of it. So that's a very good point. I mean, he did not even go into that realm. He just still, you know, to this day, he's just like, why are these people saying that I'm mentally ill? Why are these people saying I'm crazy? You know? It was one of the things with me after I interviewed him. I felt bad, you know, and it's funny being in a situation where you feel bad, talking about someone who did something that Luca did, but I felt bad because I was like, well, I obviously can't just pretend, you know, that, you know, but, you know, even like right now, I'm like, oh, you know, Luca's going to be so upset to hear me say that, you know, obviously he's, you know, and it's ridiculous to even feel that way, but not ridiculous, it's too strong of a word, but you get my point. But I mean, yeah, so that's a very good point. Again, it's something I never even thought about, because right off the bat, he was so like, you know, again, just even the thought, he's like, oh, it's a joke in our family that I'm mentally ill, ha ha ha, kind of thing. I'm like, dude, come on, man. You know, like, seriously.
Yeah.
Like, things like this don't happen to me. You know, I don't get charged with doing things like this, you know.
What I found fascinating, too, is that he seemed to combine, and very much like the guy that I dealt with in Trophy Kill, it seemed like, again, I'll get back onto these Canadians being influenced, but it seemed like he tried to put in that video every conceivable, horrendous, horrific crime, the necrophilia, the cannibalism, the dog in the video,
the dog, I know.
And then other aspects of it in the social media, no one had ever topped him in terms of posting a video online and then pre-marketing it like it was a music video that was going to come up from a highly anticipated band. So he did unprecedented promotional work. They call it premeditation. It's both. And you could see that he tried to outdo every other one-time killer in every single
right.
conceivable way, no matter where they were in history, even. And then to have a manhunt at the level of Interpol, again, unprecedented. And then to say
right.
that none of this meant anything seems beyond disingenuous.
Well, and just quickly, but because I know, you know, we're getting near the end, but and we haven't really talked about the video for good reason, and I'm recommending people don't watch the video as opposed to watching the video. But the thing that fascinated me the most about it was the fact that at one point he was, after he had done a whole bunch of horrific things that I won't detail, he started, like, in theory, like, having sex with the corpse. But he wasn't. He was, like, simulating, like, having sex with the corpse.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
What's worse, you know? I mean,
mm-hmm.
that's relative, but, I mean, to do something like this because of some out-of-control lust thing that you just...
Yeah.
Or to do something like this for show, like, oh, this will look really perverted and freak... This will really freak people out if I do this.
Yeah.
As opposed to, I mean... I just found it very interesting. I mean, in the history, and I'm obviously a big fan is not the correct word, but I'm a student of true crime, and I can't think of anything. I mean, obviously there's people that pose people after the murder and so on and so forth.
Sure.
But this was, I mean, he was pretending to do something that other people actually would do, if you get what I'm trying to say. He was pretending to be sicker than he actually was, and that is even odder than being that sick in the first place to me, if that makes
it's evidence of him really overreaching in terms of, again, it's every unprecedented thing rolled into
right.
one to ensure that he would be famous. And for him to say, again, he even disputed that he wasn't looking at stories about himself in that Berlin cafe, but certainly he was. That's not a rumor.
That's what he was doing. Yeah. Yeah.
I
think he told me he was watching Eva Gardner movies or something of that nature. And just even that he would say that is just an odd thing.
Absolutely. Yes.
You know, yeah. Yeah.
I want to thank you, Brian, for coming on and talking about My Son, the Killer, the untold story of Luca Magnotta, one ice pick, one lunatic, one ice pick. This is a Wild Blue Press, so tell us how they might be able to look at your other work. Do you have a Facebook page? Tell us a little bit about contact.
Yeah, I mean, I have a website. It's brianwhitneyauthor.com. I do have a page on Facebook. This is my third book with Wild Blue. They're a great publisher.
Absolutely.
This is a real quick aside. Right now I'm working on a book with Rob Dick, who is the guy that bailed Casey Anthony out of jail and lived with her in her house for 10 days with Leonard Padilla, who the other. So we're going to be shopping that pretty soon. It's a little plug.
Yeah.
If there's any... I keep busy and I like what I do. So and Wild Blue is awesome. They have a lot of great
Absolutely.
Books. I know you work with them a lot. So and Dan, I always appreciate being on your show. Hope you did a good job. It was a long day today. And
thank you very much. It's always a pleasure. Again, you bring very, very unique books to a true crime audience that's looking for something unique, and certainly this is. And also, going where some people might not go because he's so reviled, you write a book, get to Luca Magnotta and to his mother. Congratulations on a fantastic book, My Son, the Killer, the Untold Story of Luca Magnotta. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thanks so much.
Hope to hear from you again real soon, and I know we will. Thank you, Brian Whitney. Have a great night.
Thanks so much, Dan. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Good night.